It gives me great pleasure today to welcome Sanjeev Shankar, who has a fascinating story to tell. He started off in architecture, working as an architect, and then his life has taken many interesting turns, and we were just discussing the work he's been doing with rural communities, but also weaving and gardening and many other aspects. And he uses his training in design and science and architecture to merge traditional knowledge with contemporary patterns, look at sustainable solutions with socio-economic challenges. He's a recipient of the Schlesing Fellowship and the Dard Fellowship from Germany, and his work has been featured at the Royal Institute of British Architects in London and a number of other institutions. And he won the Outstanding Young Engineer Award and the 10 Great Ideas to Change the World competition at the Indian Institute of Technology in Mumbai. So welcome, Sanjeev, and we look forward to your presentation. And afterwards there are drinks, so there's time for questions, but feel free to hang around and have drinks and have an informal conversation afterwards as well.
Can we please start?
Yeah, from there.
Dear friends, may I please request you all to close your eyes, please. I want to thank Professor Malhi for inviting me to Oxford and to all of you for finding the time to be part of this story and this journey. What I am sharing with you today is very difficult to share in words. And yet, words, images and media is what we have over here. Each one of us contributes to knowledge. And over the last 13 years that I have been on the road and the last 5 years that I have been in the forest, I have tried to reflect what have I gone through and what will I go through in the next few years. And one image or one diagram which I tried to draw is this. As human beings or as living beings, we all have the privilege of learning. We all learn. Curiosity and wonder is what defines us as kids. And learning constitutes not just formal learning in universities like this, but also informal learning in the way you talk, in the way you walk, when you garden, when you weave, when you sing to your children. And I felt that was the first word which came to my mind about what constitutes our life and our existence. And then we go on to reflect. Places like this, which are institutions of learning, are places for reflection, places for thinking, places for learning where we make mistakes and where we should go from now. And then we go on to develop. As engineers, as architects, as scientists, we pride ourselves in the world of development. As a developing country or as a developed country, we think of development and we use the word growth in daily parlance at a rate which doesn't allow us to reflect on what constitutes true growth and true development. And finally, we improve. And I feel improvement is one of the most important lessons of being a human being. What constitutes improvement? And I feel this cycle, or this circle over here, represents each one of us as individuals, as communities, as nationalities, and also as a species. We are not Indians, Americans, British first. I feel we are living beings, if at all there is a boundary to be created. I come from India, and we have to be born somewhere, so this is what I felt is the first word which comes to my mind, especially for people who haven't been to India. In common parlance, India is declared as a developing country. The first word which comes to people when they term anything as developing is poverty. I try to reflect about the word poverty. What is poverty? Yes, India has 816 million rural poor people, but that is economic poverty. There is no dearth of wisdom, of knowledge, of skills which have evolved over the last few thousand years. But friends, what does economic poverty do to you? Living with people teaches you about this nexus. When you are economically poor and hungry, you are unable to think, and you are extremely dependent on the environment. You have a serious impact on an environment, you need energy, you have serious issues of inequity and migration. And this nexus is my personal subjective depiction of what I have experienced over the last 13 years, living with people, living with communities, and then traveling to places like this. This speculation and this graph may not be only of India, actually it's representative of every country in different ways and to different scales. We have issues of time, we have issues of money. When does money become a need and when does it become a greed? It's an important question for all of us to reflect. And how does it influence policy? How does it influence construction, an industry where I come from and where I work and feel challenged on a daily basis? Ultimately, what does it do to your identity? What does it do to your knowledge? And what does it do to skills and crafts? We'll come to this graph later, but this is my personal reflection of the complex interconnections which make us all. This, for me, is an ecosystem in itself. This, for me, is a daily challenge which you face when you do not term yourself as architects or engineers or scientists. This is a depiction of reality. So what do you do when you are faced with this as an engineer or as an architect? I try to define this for myself, working in a place which goes few thousand years back, and today we are in the 21st century. A place which shows you what life was a long time ago, and yet it is not a long time ago, it is today. And I try to redefine my role as that of an activist and a catalyst who also tries to invent and innovate systems and processes. This was my definition for myself as my purpose of living. Three words which I wanted to share with all of you is the act of seeing, the act of valuing, and the act of imagining. How do you all see? Do you see with your eyes? Or do you see and feel with your feet, bare feet? How do you value anything in life? Is value only about money? Or is there a whole world of intangible values related to relationships, related to trust? And finally, how do you imagine your future? We are all somehow contributing to imagination through every single action. Where do you spend your time? Where do you spend your money? How do you prioritize? Each step contributes to this. And I felt in my own journey, living with indigenous tribes, I realized they live a different reality. And there are a million different realities between Meghalaya in India and Oxford in the United Kingdom. 2005, I got the first opportunity to stay in Nagaland. Nagaland is on the Indo-Burmese border, one of the most remote parts of the Indian subcontinent. And this project essentially introduced me for the first time to a different way of thought. Nagaland has 16 main indigenous tribes. These are hunter-gatherers, each tribe with its own distinct ritual, language, ways of weaving, cuisine, and also habitat. Each tribe has an extremely phenomenal relationship with their environment. Their environment is a forest, where the forest is not just outside them, but within them. What does it mean to live in a forest and develop an intimate relationship with plants and animals? What does it really mean to be in an environment which is like this? This is one of the huts where I was staying. It uses two main materials where every motif in the hut is inspired by their visual language. The two materials are Kona grass and local timber, all of it brought within 5,000 meters of walking distance. What is sustainability for them? What is conservation for them? They may not understand these words, but their lifestyle underlines their way of life and their responsibility towards the planet in every single way. The roof over here made of Kona grass lasts 7 years, and they change this roof in a ceremonial festive procession. As I started living with them, I realized that it's important to learn first before trying to do anything with indigenous communities. It's very important to learn because it changes your judgment. It changes your way of looking. I started weaving. The first few examples of weaving which I learned from an indigenous craftsman developed our relationship, because as they saw me, they first thought I am a person from the cities who has come to work for a few hours and few days and then I will go back. And that is not a great relationship to have when you really want to contribute and you really want to see a constructive dialogue happen. When you learn with these tribes, they realize that you are being humble, and humility is one of the first things which they value. As I went on, I started weaving more and more, and I realized that weaving for them is like breathing. A woman is breastfeeding and weaving. There's no separation between the two. There is no work and there is no play. And the first time I asked them from a mathematical point of view, how many moves do you make or how many holes do you make, they made a mistake, which means knowledge for them does not reside in the brain, but actually it's in their body. Over a course of 4 weeks, I developed a range of products and artifacts, weaving with them, developing colors using natural herbs and local material as part of the project. And ultimately, I went on to realize that that knowledge of using local material can also be applied in other places. I want to share one project with you which was done in 2008 and 2009 using this material to your left. For those of you who do not know this material, this is actually a cooking oil can which is commonly available in North India. The closest reference for you is the 1 liter olive oil can. This was a project as part of a public eco art festival in India, where we looked at issues of environment, climate change and resilience. And I tried to respond to that question with the act of recycling and repurposing. Over a period of 3 months, with 150 men, women and children, we collected 967 waste discarded cooking oil cans, which everyone gave it to me free of cost because they thought it was of no value and they treated it as dirt. We created this. This was a suspended canopy made out of 967 cooking oil cans, and there's a 4-degree drop in temperature below the canopy. But what was really interesting through this project was transformation. Transformation of the mind, transformation of the way you see and value something. At the beginning, no one wanted to work with me because they thought there's no point in working with him, and also because they were extremely busy in their own lives. They needed to work morning to evening to make the little money they needed to survive the next day. At the end of it, we had more than 200 people working in this project, and there were more waiting to be part of this journey. What is this journey? How do we take something as a starting point and go through that journey of transformation? Some other projects which are related to traditional knowledge and how do you connect it with contemporary needs. This is a 650-year-old craft in South India. It's called the Kolhapuri footwear craft. And I worked with the communities over here and combined it with contemporary sports footwear to create a local cooperative with 200 women. Today it's a $1 million turnover owned by the local men and women in a village called Athini. Again, this craft was 650 years old, but we combined it with contemporary needs and turned it into a source of value through imagination. Top right is a series of lamps done in Nagaland, and bottom right is actually a series of scarf joints done between South India and London, which is inspired by boat building. Again, about 750-year-old craft called Palayodams in South India. And in the last 2 years, I've been working on this project, which is related to bamboo, natural fiber. The cost of this tropical facade system is $2 per square feet. How do you create impact, and how do you create an appropriate technology which can be used by anyone in a situation of extreme constraints? This project is actually an earthquake-resistant timber structural system done between London and Himalayas. And top right is actually an ongoing project for a space for meditation in a forest in South India. As I was working with these projects, some of the people who like these projects asked me a very important question. The oil can canopy which you saw was presented in London and New York, and people in the audience asked me, Sanjeev, can you replicate this in other parts of the world? And while I was very happy to say yes to that question, it left me with a disturbing thought. That little voice which speaks in each one of us. I was left with this thought and this image. The image on the left is a blooming flower in the Zuku Valley of Flowers in Nagaland. The image on the right is a stone quarry. It can be anywhere in the world. It can be in Italy, in Vermont, in the United States, or in Rajasthan, in India. We are all complicit in this. As human beings, as engineers, and as architects, we all contribute to this. Whether we use stone, concrete, sand, any material which is industrialized, in some way or the other, we are contributing immensely to this. And if we carry on making buildings like this, the building we are sitting in right now, over the next 100-200 years, we cannot go away from this method of thought and this method of knowledge. However, I did not have answers to that question, and I carried on. I was still not happy with this image. This could be London or New York or Delhi, Bombay. By the way, New York was a forest 400 years ago called Manahatta. And every building that we build, it takes us away from this into this. And as an architect, as an engineer, I was forced to question, do I contribute to this reality or is there something over here? This is actually a strangler fig in a forest in South India. That is a cellular structure of a plant, and this is a plant which I took in the Amsterdam Botanical Garden. I realized that the word which stood out for me is impact. Not just socio-economic impact, which the government is really concerned about, but socio-economic ecological impact. What we do should not just make a positive socio-economic impact, but we need to bring about ecology and weave it into our action. We need to question the thought that ecology is a price we have to pay for social cultural development. 2010, there was a competition between Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay, and University of Cambridge for ideas which will change the world in the next 50 years. I was farming in South India and doing my studies in London, and I submitted this concept, which was of a green brick, a brick which is part botanical and part structural, which has native plants and seeds combined with slow curing non-fired ceramics or earth. This idea won the competition, and I was invited to Himalayas to work with the local communities to handle three critical challenges facing them. First, landslides, earthquakes, and flash floods. Himalayas is in zone 5 earthquake region. It was still an idea. And as I started reflecting and working with the communities, I started thinking of the following questions. Can what we do, can what we build, ensure forest regeneration and promote good health? Can our buildings, can our systems, can our technologies, instead of wiping out forests, contribute to forest growth? Can it become a source for nourishment? Can it become a host biome for orchids, mushrooms, other epiphytic plants, and food for humans? Can it support 1,274 birds and mammal species across 523 genres? Can it demonstrate exceptional robustness and resilience under extreme climatic conditions with minimum material and maintenance cost? Can it nurture indigenous crafts and knowledge? And most importantly, can it ensure social justice, equality, sensitivity, informality, and compassion? And this brings us to Living Root Bridges. My search over the last 13 years led me to this. Living Root Bridges are locally known as Jing, King, Jri. This is in the Khasi language. What is a bridge? Jing, King, Jri essentially stands for connecting points in three-dimensional space. Space over here can be space between humans and plants, humans and animals, between one reality and another reality. Bridge is a metaphor for connection and interconnectedness. We are today here, and this is the place I'm coming from. This place is Meghalaya. It is on the Indo-Burmese-Bangladesh border. Meghalaya is the wettest place on the planet. The annual precipitation in Meghalaya is approximately more than 10 times the precipitation you receive in Oxford. That is approximately 470 inches. As I was working in these places and I realized that I need to define what I'm experiencing, and this definition of Living Root Bridges is again undergoing change based on the discoveries I have made till now. Living Root Bridges are ficus-based ecosystems within dense subtropical moist broadleaf forest ecoregions of Himalayas. These are nurtured and grown by indigenous Khasi and Jaintia tribes over a period of 15 to 20 years and last several centuries. This definition again can be challenged and changed because this is empirical data. As I discover more, and many of you may discover, you can add and modify this definition. But as of now, this is what I feel is an appropriate reflection of what I have experienced. This is the material we are looking at. This is ficus. And by the way, there are 900 different species of ficus, a lot of it not scientifically documented or analyzed by the scientific community. These are the aerial roots of ficus. The communities use a technique of inoculation or grafting, where they activate the cells. And it is human-plant interaction. It is a unique reflection of what happens when humans and plants work together. I want to talk a little bit about the communities here. These are Khasi and Jaintia tribes. Meghalaya is a unique state in India. They follow a matrilineal system, which means women own property. So we have a very unique system of land ownership in the state, which actually is, in my opinion, progressive, because it has allowed and nurtured some of these ancient rituals and knowledge systems. The knowledge of living root bridges passes on from one generation to another. You don't live, actually, perhaps, to see what you have done. These are collective societies. These are not individual societies. Some of the villages in these societies actually do not have names. We also do not have maps. There is no cartography. People in many of these villages call each other with song tunes, which means when you are born, your mother gives you a song tune. You do not have individual names. So I am not Sanjeev, he is not George, he is not Professor Malhi, but we are actually tunes in space. I'm sharing this for you to reflect what it means to live in a collective system and a collective society which has over centuries evolved a highly sustainable system of balancing individual needs with collective needs. These societies were cut off from the mainland. They had no help from the government. They had no external material because of their remoteness. And because of their geography and a unique orography, they had to find solutions within the constraints. And there is something about living in extreme constraints. Your sensitivity is heightened. You are forced to find solutions collectively, because if you don't, there is no survival. These people follow an eco-theandric view, which means there is no separation between nature, man, and God, which also means there is no separation between you, me, the chair between us, and the voice which is echoing in this room. Please notice the way he is holding and the way his hands are moving. His eyes are closed. They are not used to photography, many of them. These are some of the tools they use. It's an ancient civilization which actually is very, very good at blacksmithing, weaving, and gardening. And yet, they do not call themselves by any of these names. The movement of the hand is actually different from the way we use our hands. This is one of the bridges which I want to start off with. This is a double-decker, double-tire living root bridge in Nongriath village. Please notice the scale of the bridge. This is a local tribal woman. She comes here every afternoon to wash her clothes. The two tires were grown because the bottom tire gets submerged in flash floods. These regions are highly turbulent with extreme climatic imbalances, receiving an annual precipitation which is highest in the world and being in regions which are really remote has forced them to find solutions which are unique. What is also interesting for you to observe is there is only one tree on the right. What is happening below the soil is far more than what the human eye can see. The aerial roots over here are coming down, and most of the rocks over here are limestone rocks. And what's also interesting is an absolute relationship between the ecology, the geology, and the hydrology. Everything is interconnected. In order to maintain these bridges, they have to maintain the water, the soil, and the air. Ficus itself is a keystone species and is actually used for soil remediation. In terms of dimensions, and a lot of these dimensions have been taken by communities. Often when I'm not in the forest, I call the communities and they do not have any measurement devices, so I just ask them to measure their footstep and call me back. It's a method of sharing knowledge, it's a method of bringing everyone together. The span over here is an important aspect, because you will just see every bridge at a different stage of growth and of different span. We are looking at two spans essentially here, 17 meters and 25 meters, and the tree itself is 27 meters. So from a structural engineering point of view, this is not a cantilevered structure. because it's connected over here. This is not even a suspension bridge or a truss-based bridge. Perhaps it's a novel structural system which cannot be yet partitioned in existing ways of defining structures. Please notice the person at the top. Every day the bridge is used as a critical rural connectivity infrastructure solution. It's not an art project. It's not a project which is only done for someone's fantasy. It is critical infrastructure need. The space on the left is actually used for agriculture, and on the right is a village community roughly consisting of 50 to 60 households. As I started documenting each bridge ecosystem, I started talking to a lot of tribesmen and understanding how they may have done this over the last few centuries. You start by selecting the site. Site selection and geography is a critical aspect of this process. You may either plant a ficus sapling or find a ficus sapling. Please notice the number on the bottom right, that is time. Time is an essential aspect of this process, because here the job of the architect or the whole village community begins with this step. You create a bamboo scaffold. So bamboo is actually planted near ficus, and the third plant which is planted near the ficus is areca cacu or a local palm. All three plants are available all over the world around the tropical ecology. With the aerial roots which come out from the ficus tree, they create a root guidance system. These roots are gravitropic roots, which means they move towards water. In order for them to perform as a bridge, you have to direct it in a certain direction. Now, when the roots are really thin, you see the woman on the right, she is weaving the roots. When the roots are really thin, you guide them in a certain direction because they have high tension and low ductility. So you can guide them in a certain direction, but you need to protect it, and the protection over here is provided by areca cacu leaves. The protection is to keep them intact from the heavy tropical rain, but also to provide them nutrition. This is year 6. At about year 12 to 15, these roots which are woven and inosculated start merging together. So you actually have the structure strengthening with time, which is opposite to contemporary structures which weaken with time, because this is living structure. It is much like your collagen, where you exercise every day and you become stronger. In this case, it's cellulose. The more stress there is, the stronger it becomes. And finally, they use local timber, heavy stones, to plug the poles in the structure, which performs as a load test in itself. In brief, this is the process that we go through. You plant the ficus, you create a bamboo scaffold. The next step is creating a root guidance system, followed by root inosculation. And you finally do a load test to create a living root bridge over a period of 15 to 20 years, at least. These are some of the other bridges at various stages of growth. This is approximately in stage 2 or stage 3. It is still growing, and you can see how they are plugging the holes by putting dead weight on it. Every time you walk on it, the bridge becomes stronger because it's living tissue. It's just like a tree, it becomes stronger. This is another bridge. This actually is a mature bridge, approximately 80 to 120 years old. The holes over here have been plugged by heavy stones, and owing to the rain, soil compaction occurs and the bridge becomes stronger and stronger. Please note the scale of the person. This bridge can be visited by people. You can park your car, you can trek down about 30 to 40 minutes, and you can be on this bridge. Over the last 4 years, I have seen the impact of humans on this ecosystem. The government and people do not realize that this is a living ecosystem. Tourism in these cases has to be really controlled, responsible, with thresholds. Because even though these are really resilient socio-ecological systems and very robust, we do not know the impact of carbon emissions, climate change on ficus. This is a bridge which you just noticed. It's a double tire bridge. But the morphology is not just limited to bridges. They have created viewing towers, staircases, and entire mountainscapes which have been adapted using ficus aerial roots to prevent soil erosion and landslides. As I was documenting this and writing a scientific paper, I realized that to communicate this to an audience which is used to a fixed sense of time, I have to code this differently. So the column on the right is essentially safety level, and this is growth stage. So 5 over here is the safest. So the mature living root bridge which you just saw in Rivai and Nohavit village is in stage 5. Every day I have seen 50 to 100 people walking on the bridge, standing on it. The longest bridge which I have documented in Mokernot village is approximately 250 feet in span, which is approximately 86 meters. That is a substantial span in engineering terms. How does it compare with other contemporary solutions and construction systems? These are bridges built by the government approximately 50 years ago, 40 to 50 years ago, with an investment ranging from $50,000 to $100,000, and these bridges in these extreme environments are collapsing. These are steel suspension bridges with concrete foundations. The nature of wear and tear is mostly related to corrosion and poor maintenance. Because these environments are really remote and the government is faced with extreme challenges, it's very difficult to maintain these bridges and send specialists every year or every few years. Bamboo bridges break down in 2 to 3 years because the joints in those cases are not fixed, continuous, contiguous joints like living root bridges. And because cut bamboo corrodes and rots away in the heavy rain. But I discovered something very interesting. The indigenous tribes have taken their knowledge, woven it over the steel cables, and made a hybrid bridge, which in engineering terms you can call a retrofit bridge. That's a tribesman who is standing on a hybrid bridge which is approximately 10 to 12 years old. And he uses it every day. What are the attributes of these ecosystems? There is no environmental damage. There is minimum material and maintenance cost because ficus and plant is available everywhere. There is carbon sequestration, there is also remediation of soil water, and there is progressive increase in load bearing capacity with time and use. Most importantly, ficus is a keystone species and supports other plants and animals, and these bridges are done by communities. It is grassroots involvement. They have done it without special input from the outside. These are just some of the attributes which I have listed. There may be many more which each one of you can contribute. I started questioning the way we build today with what I have experienced and where we can go 100 to 200 years from now. Do we continue to build like this, or do we learn from these systems and perhaps merge the two systems? And as an architect, as an engineer, one of the simplest and low-cost methods is to draw. And I realized when I was drawing these bridges, it changes the way you think, because we are so much used to Euclidean geometry. And yet, I realized that while I was drawing, my cognition was heavily influenced in the way I was taught engineering and design. I was still drawing trusses, and I was still drawing viridial girders. And perhaps these bridges are different from this. We do not know that yet. Today, the bridges and the construction methods we use are extremely safe because there is a huge pool of scientists and engineers globally. There's a lot of documented knowledge, and you have exactly calculable data. And yet, the first person who built a building like this did not know that it can stand up. you are comfortable sitting in this room having a slab of 2 tons over your head thinking it will not fall on you because you have built and grown up in such environments. But the first person who built such buildings or who did experiments like Gaudi or Fry Otto, they were literally creating empirical data and knowledge. On the other hand, living root bridges have low safety during initial growth stage. It has a long growth phase and you need sensitivity as a community. What you also need is appropriate growth conditions in terms of soil, moisture, pH and nutrients. On the other hand, today's method of construction costs a lot. It has relatively short lifespan of 40 to 80 years as compared to few centuries. It creates extensive environmental damage, has a high carbon footprint, and is really dependent on a centralized system of funding and specialized knowledge. On the one hand, we are looking at issues of efficiency, optimization, and strength of materials. On the other hand, living root bridges is all about redundancy, a lot of irregularity and complexity. And that exactly is what contributes to its resilience in extreme environments. I try to draw some graphs to compare these two systems. On the one hand, we have bamboo and steel suspension bridges where the strength and robustness decreases with time. In the case of steel suspension bridges, about 50 to 60 years, bamboo bridges 3 to 4 years, and in the case of living root bridges, it increases with time. This graph in this region can change because it's a speculative graph. And yet, in the case of ficus, the aerial roots come down and then they take over the host and become primary roots or primary structures. In terms of the Young's modulus of ficus, this is again a speculation. The Young's modulus will keep increasing with time in terms of stiffness and will overtake timber and bamboo. So what can living root bridges teach us? Other than many aspects of fundamental research and environment, it can also teach us issues related to policy, empowerment and health. Most importantly, from a scientific research domain, we have a lot of interdisciplinary overlapping aspects over here. Since these are plant-based systems, we are looking at ecology and botany, but we are also looking at horticulture, agriculture, because each bridge is a biome, supports a lot of fern, moss, figs, which are eaten by a lot of animals and birds. We have aspects related to social science and engineering. And if we change these words, we are looking at humans and environments. More importantly, we are looking at the future. Are we going to continue to build cities like that, or can we learn from these systems and incorporate it into a future where we have time? So for all of you who are from many different fields, I'm highlighting some of the research questions which may be pertinent. Each ficus ecosystem is dependent on a unique pollinator fig wasp. So for 900 ficus species, we have 900 unique fig wasps. So understanding the ficus ecosystem is the first research question. How does geography, site, and its physiology work? What is the cell and tissue structure and how does it change with growth? In the case of forestry and agriculture, how can you improve this technique and apply it to address some of the most critical issues facing our planet? How can you look at deforestation? Because ficus is actually used for rainforest regeneration. There's a case study in Mexico where ficus has been used for that. And how can we connect it with forestation? How can you study inosculation and grafting, which is a horticultural technique, and improve it? How can it be designed as a food source? How can these bridges become food farms? From an anthropology and ethnobotanical point of view, how do you understand the indigenous mind? How do you understand their food, medicine, and habitat? How can we learn from their land ownership? And most importantly, what does their philosophy and worldview teach us? from a planning point of view, how can this influence the future city plan? How can future cities be actually future ecosystems and future forests? How can we create new structural systems inspired by these plants? For those of you who are structural and civil engineers, how can we really understand their performance under extreme climatic conditions? And how can you redesign the process of growth to improve the performance? Before we go any further, I want to share some videos with you to actually share this experience for those of you who haven't visited these parts of India. So where do we go from here? When you experience something like this in the forest, you start asking, what do you do with this knowledge? Is this knowledge only for the past, or can there be a role for it for the future? So one of the things which I believe is important is to conserve these structures. And we have confirmed knowledge that there are not one or two or 22 which I have documented, but at least 73 across 24 remote forests, perhaps hundreds more, not just limited to India, maybe in other parts. So conservation, scientific study, and most importantly, how can we apply it for current situations? Human impact is important, and many of you at the School of Geography and Environment are looking at the issue of human impact on ecosystems. In terms of application, how can we look at issues of reforestation, sustainable agriculture, and forestry? This is the global forest loss map, and I wanted to propose a vision for the next 50 or 100 years. Red represents areas of extreme forest loss, and if you notice, all of these areas, or 9 of the 10 areas, are between Tropic of Capricorn and Tropic of Cancer. From Bolivia and Brazil and Nicaragua to Indonesia, Congo, Nigeria, and also Cambodia. I propose a ficus-based forest regeneration where each living root bridge ecosystem can become a nucleus to regenerate the forest. And if you look at the scientific reference at the bottom, this case study is from Mexico, where they have tested out ficus as a source for rainforest regeneration. So if we start growing, this is the place where I'm coming from, this is Meghalaya, and that acts as a mothership, or the place of reference. And we start propagating this around the world, and it starts growing over time, and contributes to socio-ecological resilience. Year 10, other than places of extreme loss, we are also looking at other places where it can be grown, all between Tropic of Capricorn and Tropic of Cancer, though ficus is also seen in other parts in temperate climates. Year 15. And finally, I want to share this graph again, which is where we started with. This is not just a depiction of a developing country or India. This, in fact, in my opinion, is a start towards understanding the interconnectedness which we are all facing in the world we live in. Thank you.